This is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I'm with Johnny Marr and Ryan Jarman of the band The Cribs. Guys, how you doing?
Yeah, we're doing good.
Very well.
Fantastic. Well, the new album is called Ignore the Ignorant. It's the first album that you've done as a foursome since Johnny's joined the band. So how did this little romance take place? Now, you guys are living in Portland, Oregon, right?
Well, Johnny was, and my brother Gary, who plays bass, he was living there. Me and Ross still live in England. So, but because Gary was in Portland and Johnny was in Portland, that's where they ended up meeting. You know, which is weird, seeing as how we've only, like, all our life we've lived like 45 minutes from where Johnny lives in Manchester, and we have never bumped into each other at all, and yet they travel 5,000 miles, and yeah, they met up in Portland, and you guys just got talking, I guess.
Yeah, we became friends. I was already a fan of the Cribs, and in the early part of I guess 2005, when New Fellas came out, I got really into that, and I really liked the band, as I say. And when Gary and I just bumped into each other, we struck up a friendship, you know, and just two musicians in a new city. And so very, very soon after that, Ryan and Ross and I met at the Glastonbury Festival. And very soon after that, Ryan and I bumped into each other again, and we decided to just get together to play, just to see what would happen, really. There wasn't any grand scheme or any sort of career plans or anything like that. Far from it. We just got together in a funky little room, and in the cold in the north of England, and started playing some riffs, and then we immediately started writing songs. All of us have been in, you know, being in groups from our early teens, which is a very important part of how we get along. And we all know when it sounds good that you follow that, and that chemistry is very important. So that's how we got to be in the group. It just felt natural, really, for me and for the other boys as well.
Yeah, because musically it worked, you know, it kind of like it fit together very well and worked like straight away. But I also think that, like, as people, like, you know, philosophically and stuff, you know, we're a good match for each other as well, you know. It's which is equally as important as musicianship, you know what I mean? You can't be in a band with someone who you disagree. I mean, I know that a lot of people are in bands with people that don't get along with and they make good music, but
we can't do that, though, can we?
No, because we kind of have, our band is just, has always been just like, especially when we were brothers, you know, when we first started, there's always had to be a sense of unity to the band, you know what I mean? A sense of shared direction. So
now, Johnny, of course, you have, aside from the Smiths, you have played with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you did a little bit of a stint in the band Modest Mouse.
Yeah.
So a lot of people might be wondering, are you a permanent member of the Cribs, or is this something that you might just be doing temporarily?
I can see why people might think that, but I'm a permanent member of the Cribs, and very happy to be so. I understand that question because I've been lucky enough to I just think I've followed my own map, so to speak, worked with a lot of great people. But it comes back to the answer to the first question. When the chemistry is really good, it's very, very important, and it kind of comes before everything else, really. That's where my life's been since being 13 or 14, you know. So when you find yourself in the right group, unless you have sort of personal issues, which we don't, it kind of dictates your life, really. So we're thinking about making the next record, and I understand that question, but it's not as big a deal as it might be, you know.
Now, Ryan, how long was the process where you kind of went from, holy shit, we have Johnny Marr in the band, to, well, he's just another member? How long did it take to feel natural?
Pretty swiftly, really. I think that from the moment we started playing together and we started writing, like, the first thing that we ever did, we didn't get together and be like, oh, let's jam on some old Cribs songs, or like, oh, let's, you know, do a cover or whatever. There was no feeling out in that way. It was just kind of, as soon as we got together, it was the first thing we did was start writing. And as soon as that happens, you don't think of the personnel involved, you know what I mean? You think of I just think of the songs. I don't think any of us really thought about it. We didn't realise the significance of it particularly. You know what I mean? I'm sure that when we were driving over on the day, I was kind of excited. I was like, oh, this is going to be cool. You know what I mean? This is like something for the scrapbook or whatever. But then as soon as you start writing the songs, all that completely goes out of the window. You know what I mean? It's like...
You get down to work, don't you?
I always believe that the songs are just like a, like the music when it starts coming is just a higher, like it's more powerful than the band or the sum of its parts. You know what I mean? So I just kind of ended up concentrating on that. And by the time that we actually got around to having conversations of, oh, are we in the band? You know, are we going to be a four piece? You know, is Johnny a member? There were so many songs written that answered the question. You know,
and also I think just weirdly, and it's almost like a matter of synchronicity. I happened to be able to be appear with the band at the same time. I was just free to. Back in the UK when the band were doing some dates on a tour, so I was playing some of the old songs just for fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
That was simultaneous to us doing exactly what Ryan's just talked about. So the old songs, they didn't have to wait for a year to find out whether we sounded right on the old song, because I was doing that for fun anyway. You know, I'd get out the first night, do four songs, and the next night do five, and then, you know, by the time we got to play Reading, I walked on stage as a member of the band when we headlined the Reading Festival. Yeah.
Before we get into some of the songs and some of the guitar stuff, where is the band based right now? How do you guys work? I mean, when are you in Portland? When are you in England? How do you all meet?
The fact of the matter is that we're together all the time. We had a 1 4-week break, 4.5 weeks maybe, in the summer, which is the longest that we've been apart since I've been in the band, and Gary and I went to Portland at that time, and Ryan was in London and Ross was in Wakefield, but that was because we weren't working, you know, but the rest of the time we're together.
But the band, it's just not really, it doesn't need to be based anywhere, you know what I mean? Like for the last few years of my life, I never had anywhere to live anyway. I lived a completely nomadic existence, you know what I mean? So, I feel like the band kind of does that too, you know? But, when we were writing this album, we would get together for a couple of weeks in Manchester, and then sometimes we'd go over to Portland for a couple of weeks, and the change of scenery really was, really good for creativity, you know? We'd write all these songs in Manchester, and then when you get to Portland, you'd feel the songs changed, you know, because the scenery and the vibe changed. So I feel like that's a really, really positive thing, you know. I like the fact that the band doesn't have a set base anymore. It keeps you... I feel like a set base could possibly limit what you can do creatively.
Let's talk about your guitar sounds a little bit and how you guys work with each other. Now, Johnny, you, of course, are very famous for playing Rickenbacker's 330, which you started off with pretty much. But lately, I've been seeing that you're playing Jaguars and Jazzmasters.
Yeah. That was purely a pragmatic decision, because both those guitars you mentioned, the Rickenbacker, I obviously had a real love for, but I first started playing a Rickenbacker because of its limitations, if the truth be told, and I started playing the Jaguar for the same reason, because I both those guitars forced me to play in a certain kind of way. And
how so?
Well, you can't really do blues rock on a Rickenbacker, I don't think.
Yeah.
And I don't really think blues rock is I don't think a Jaguar is the right guitar for a blues rock musician either. So particularly with the Jaguar recently, I had this idea of a very punchy, stinging kind of Fender sound. And then when I started to play in Modest Mouse, I just came upon one. Isaac Brock had one lying around, and I started writing on that. And it fitted what I do really anyway, because I can make it kind of sound like Rickenbacker-ish. I can make it sound clean, but I also do quite a lot of dirty stuff on it. But the actual way... The way the architecture of that particular guitar is, even if I'm playing kind of distorted, I still have to kind of I have to be on my toes. I have to wrestle with it a little bit. So I kind of think those guitars are a little bit like driving an old vintage sports car very, very fast, particularly if I'm not singing it, when I'm not being, you know, in this band, I'm playing the guitar, and that's what I do. And there's a lot of things that can go a little wrong with those guitars, and I like that. It keeps me on my toes.
Now, Ryan, I've seen you play a few different types of guitars, Fender Mustangs, Gibson ES-335s.
Yeah.
Do you have a main guitar that you're using now?
Well, my main guitar now is, yeah, it's the Gibson 335, but when we first started, I used to use Mustangs because that was the only guitar that I had. I had a vintage Mustang that I'd saved up for, and I just always really, really loved those guitars. I always thought they were really fun to play, and they looked great. But to be honest with you, when I went into the studio to record our third record, and we were in the studio with Alex Kapranos from Franz Ferdinand, and he lent me his 335 for the studio, and it just sounded so much better. I was just really into the sound. I really liked the fact that, you know, the semi-acoustic lent itself to feedback, you know, and it kept the like when I'd be playing, I could always feel that as soon as I stopped, the guitar would feed back, and I really liked the fact that it gave the music and or the performance like an element of threat, kind of. You know what I mean? Like you could feel the feedback building up all the time. So I don't know. I just found it really fun to play. I just thought it sounded good. So that's why I moved on to one. You know, just because. I was quite dogmatic about the Mustang. I was always like, this is what I use, don't use anything else. I use it on every single record, but it just sounds really good. My favourite guitar that I have, though, is an Epiphone Coronet. That's the one that...
Right, yeah.
That has been on every single record, just because it's just got such a... It's such a unique-sounding instrument, you know. And they're so light and fun to play, but... At the same time, I always find that they're just so handy for the studio because it's such a distinctive tone that you can't get with any other guitar.
Now, you guys are obviously very distinctive players, so there's no real danger, I think, that you're going to sound like each other. Mm-hmm. But amp-wise, did you make specific choices? Okay, I'm going to play this amp so I don't sound like you, and vice versa. Johnny, let's start with you. What amps are you using mainly?
I use a Super Reverb, Fender Super Reverb, and a Matchless late 50s Plexi, early 60s, mm-hmm. 100 watt Plexi head, and I use those in combinations so they sound like one big amp. I use the Fender for the top end, and I use the Marshall just for the bottom end. I don't have any top end on the Marshall.
Okay.
I just use it, so I use that as the whole bottom end with that Jaguar. And the Fender takes care of it. Your ear kind of tricks you into thinking it's just one giant Fender guitar.
Ryan, how about you?
I've always just used Orange amps. I just bought one of those when we got a record deal, because I always wanted one as a kid, you know. And when I tried one out, I really liked the sound of it. So I just used that. I just used a combo, an Orange AD30. But I kind of struggle, cause, like, the one that I've got is actually just a really, really nice one, and whenever you get them on rental, they just don't sound as good as what mine does, so that's one that I'm using at the minute. I've never been one of those people who've put a great deal of thought into the amp, you know what I mean? I know how to make my Orange sound good. I kind of want to start experimenting with them a little bit more in the future, you know, because... Before that, like, the only other amps I'd have would be, like, really weird kind of old stuff, but you can't play them live because they just break down so often, you know.
Now, Johnny, you're pretty much known as an anti-soloist, if you will, but on the song City of Bugs on the new album, there's a pretty big solo. What was the reasoning for that?
It's more like a kind of, like, I don't know, post-rock... I hate these terms, but it's the quickest way of explaining it, I suppose. It's like a post-rock part that I do over and over again. And I think my attitude when I started out as the anti-solos thing really held me in good stead, because now I'm not anti-solo, but 90% of me is in the same place. So the other 10% that likes to do a solo... is you know, has to keep itself in check, that it's sort of still coming from, you know, that my taste, obviously, you know. So so what I'm saying is I haven't changed my ideology, but over the years I've started to do some solos now. I've got my very firm opinion and direction on how I like my solos to be, and you know, I genuinely like guitar music to be heady,
Right.
I like it to be heady, whether that's like, and I don't mean like necessarily lots and lots of delays and echoes and, you know, that kind of thing. But
not psychedelic per se.
No, I mean, well, psychedelic in the true sense, but not in the 60s sense. I like for it to be sort of heady and trippy, but you know, trippy can be and generally is more along the lines of Aphex Twin and Square Pusher than some sort of kind of like 60s, you know, film or business, you know. So I like weird. I like kind of weird stuff.
Let me ask this of both of you guys. I'd love to get your opinion on the guitar in general, guitar players in general. What is your big beef with a lot of guitar players, particularly maybe shred culture?
Well, it appears to be sort of tasteless, and it is sort of aesthetically pretty corny, I think.
I don't like it when people, like, I mean, this is such an obvious thing to say, but I don't like it when people play for themselves rather than anything else. I've always been a big fan of playing for the song, you know what I mean? Like, you just have to do what's right, you know, like, as far as, like, just wanting to impress, you're only impressing other guitarists, you know what I mean? I don't see myself as writing music that is tailored specifically towards someone with a musical knowledge, you know what I mean? I think that would be utterly pointless, but by the same token, I still want to play good stuff, but I feel like, you know, some music that is so technically proficient says to me that it's been there's been 2 hours spent in the bedroom really, really, really rehearsing and not enough living going on, you know what I mean? And, like, you need to, I don't know, you know, you need to have a social life, or you need to have, well, no, you don't have to have a social life, you can be a complete recluse and a weirdo, but you need to have some worldly knowledge to make good music, you know what I mean? You don't just want to sit and practice all the time. That sucks.
You need to have something to say, I think. You know, it's akin to having a really overblown, shredding to me is akin to having an incredibly overblown vocabulary at your at your disposal, and not and saying very, very little, or saying a lot that is ultimately meaningless and just just a display of your virtuosity and you know, practice power. I'm not for 1 minute saying that, you know, underachieving is a good thing either, but it's all about, it's just like when you meet a person, you know. I don't want to sit in front of somebody who's got an incredible vocabulary, but is talking bullshit.
Right.
You know, and playing the guitar is just talking with your fingers, right?
Let me ask you this. What do you guys like about each other's guitar playing? Ryan, let's start with you. What do you like about Johnny's playing?
I really like Johnny's playing for being, I think it's very, like, romantic guitar playing, you know what I mean? I always found it to be when I was growing up, like, you know, it's like very melodic, but it's not obvious, you know, and it's it just paints a pretty picture, you know what I mean? That's like the way I always saw it. Like everyone knows Johnny's been like this really, really great guitarist, but like, there's not many guitarists that are held in high esteem that are actually tasteful players, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, that says a lot, really.
Now, Johnny, you can repay the compliment. What do you like about Ryan's playing?
It's Ryan. From when I first heard Ryan's playing, I found it to be really original, and in a way that was kind of confounding, which is always a great thing. I mean, you've got to like the tunes and riffs first, but I like when you don't know where it's coming from, and I think that is genuinely what innovation is, really. It gets harder and harder, I think, but as we've got like 40, 50 years of, you know, millions of guitarists and guitar culture, to hear somebody who is innovative, and to the player, I guess, again, this is what innovation means. To the person doing it, they'd be able to go, well, you know, there's a bit of this and a bit of that and a bit of the other, whatever. Particularly if they're modest, but to the outsider, you just kind of go, where the hell is that coming from, you know? And I kind of have a feeling that I have a feeling of recognition, but I can't analyze it.
Do you guys actually practice the guitar? Do you actually sit down and work on scales, work on riffs, work on licks, Ryan?
I don't. I've never practiced my guitar. I don't even have a guitar at home, you know.
Oh my!
That's purely down to the fact that I do love guitars and I love playing, but I feel that when we get together to write, if I haven't played my guitar in a long time, I'm really, I don't feel rusty at all, but I feel really excited to be playing, and that, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, you know what I mean? If you haven't been playing for a little while, when you start playing, I just feel so much more inspired, you know what I mean? I haven't kind of, like, run the tank dry by sitting at home and trying to write constantly, you know what I mean? Like, once we get together and we start writing, if I haven't played for a bit, then there's just, like weeks and weeks of kind of, like, pent-up ideas and frustrations that just come out. I don't know, but it's not a conscious decision to be like that. It's just, I don't know, I do have an acoustic actually at home, which I like play on a bit, but I don't sit and practice at all. And I like it when we get together to write and when we get together to record, because then we actually go through and kind of can craft like the guitar parts a little bit and refine them, and I feel like I learn a lot more from doing stuff like that than I do by sitting and playing on my own at home.
Johnny, how about you?
Not really, no. I mean, I've got a lot of guitars around, and I play more, say if I'm on the phone or if the sound's down on the television, in an absent-minded way. So I play a lot, but when I'm at home, but it's more to, as a physical kind of, it's a more of a physical thing. I think what Ryan was is also, I think what Ryan was saying is, as well, is that I think it's important to protect your inspiration and protect your enthusiasm, you know, because it is true that you can run the tank dry, and I'm careful to do that, because I can have a tendency to put aside some time to play and then really burn myself out.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't by any means by doing scales or anything like that. It's just by coming up with probably like 300 chord changes, and it's I've learned that you have to keep the romance alive, I think. So again, that's a thing of comes back to you know, everybody can do what they want, and I'm not criticising it, but the idea of sitting, putting all your energy into 8 hours, 6, 7, 8 hours of playing, and then not actually writing a decent song would terrify me, really. The thing with this group, which I wasn't quite expecting, was that Gary and Ryan are absolutely so knowledgeable about all the custom colours of different guitars and custom names and years. And an incredible, more nerdy and more knowledgeable than you know, lots than people would imagine. But and a massive romantic side and a real love of guitar culture, which I totally share. But with the only problem with that look with a lot of guitar culture is the music,
right?
You know, so I think we're trying to. I think there's a lot of modern musicians too, you know, who understand that. It's, you know, over the years when I first started out, it was really quite easy to criticise a lot of these, you know, what became called hair bands.
Yeah.
But a lot of time's passed since then, and there's plenty of musicians with intelligence, and you know, whether it's guys in Sonic Youth or Radiohead guys, or you know, or whoever it might be now, you know people who are contemporaries of the band, Edwin Collins, and these are all people who are just so, Bernard Butler, people who are so in love with the romance of guitar culture, but no better than to go down that kind of road we all, that terrible fork in the road marked boring muso.
Ryan, let me ask you a non-guitar question, but it's about some of the songs on the record. Cheat on Me, Emasculate Me. These are very big, emotional, tortured statements. Where is this coming from?
Well, I mean, I know it sounds kind of like ultra, like, cuckold kind of stuff, but it's not. I mean, those songs my brother wrote, so, you know, and I never ask him what his lyrics about, and he never asked me what my lyrics about, so I can't really say without just theorising on stuff. But I think that there's always, like with our band, there's always been the kind of unsettlement of always trying to just really having a disdain for all the macho kind of, you know, for machismo or whatever, or anything macho, you know. Rock and roll has always been such a, you know, it's always been a very macho, kind of male-dominated world, you know what I mean? Like, unfortunately, it certainly seems that way, and, like, we just kind of don't, like, I feel like in England as well, especially, there was a lot of, like the last couple of years, there were a lot of bands coming out, and they were, you know, just so full of cliche, you know, always talking about drinking and, like, you know, like, groupies and stuff like this, and it's like, we just kind of, like, wanted those songs to be a complete and utter contrast to that, you know what I mean? Like, but, these are subconscious things, you know what I mean? Just as guys, we just have a feline side, you know?
Let me ask you about another song on the record, which really, really impressed me. It's called Stick to Your Guns. Mm. That's a pretty sophisticated arrangement.
That's cool.
Yeah. How'd that one come about?
Well, it came about really out of a jam and an improvisation. I think
like a late night kind of jam kind of thing. We were just like set up and I was just singing because everyone else was playing. And that song originally was like 15 minutes long, you know. We just went round it and round it and round it. And then we edited it once, then we edited it twice, and then we went into the studio and we edited it again and got it down to like 6 minutes. So we kind of just took all the best bits, but because it was a jam, there was a lot of passages that needed bits before it, you know, and stuff like that we jammed out. And so it was really hard to edit it out, because there was loads of really tasty little bits in, but obviously didn't want to use the same devices too many times. But so yeah, there was a lot of edits done on it, you know. But I've like played violin on it because I've been a violinist for years, you know, and I just kind of felt like the song needed it. And like that thing, like I think that was a band we're now more open to using stuff like that, you know. Anything that we can play, you know, we don't want to limit ourselves, you know. If a song calls for something that one of us is capable of playing, then we're going to do it.
Well, Johnny, now comes part of the interview where we have to get to that good old Smith's question that I know you're sitting here waiting with bated breath for, but we have a little twist on it. Now, you, of course, have been offered upwards of $10 million, the Smiths, for a reunion tour.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, but we at Music Radar have passed our hats around, and we have come up with, are you ready?
Yeah.
We have come up with $1,000.
Well,
$1,000.
Well, but that would take me away from the crib, so I can't do that.
But it's $1,000, man.
Hang on a minute. Well, Ryan's nudging me to say, take it, and give him give him a cut.
Give me a tenner.
Oh, you don't have to take it. You could donate to charity. You could give it to Ryan.
Give him a cut of it.
Absolutely.
Well,
he could be the manager.
Yeah. Well, at least it's funny and it's not obscene, you know. So if the other guys want to go for that, then who would I be to turn that £1,000 down? Oh, it's dollars.
Well, we might be able to rack up the pounds.
Man, you've got to work on that exchange rate, man.
Okay, well, we'll see what we can do.
When the exchange rate, you know, goes up to like, you know, at least twice that.
There you go. And again, you don't have to keep it. You could give it to Ryan. You could donate it to charity.
Yeah, well, I would probably do that.
Okay. Hey, this is Joe Basso with Music Radar, and I've been speaking with Ryan Jarman and Johnny Marr of The Cribs. The new album is called Ignore the Ignorant. Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks.